You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais. I'm the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world. A world where our food is free from GMOs and harmful chemicals, where our food is healthy and safe for our children, our grandchildren, and generations to come. If you share our vision, please go to our website and join us by subscribing to us. And please don't forget to confirm your email. We'd also like to thank bensound.com for our new intro and outro music.
Hi, it's Carol again. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. In addition to nut and seed milks, you can use it for sprouting, making cold brew coffee, juicing, and more. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana nut milk bag on Amazon. That's Nutiana nut milk bag. Or go to Nutiana.com.
You're going to love this bag. My guest today is Dr. T. Colin Campbell. For more than 40 years, Dr. Campbell has been at the forefront of nutrition research. His legacy, the China Project, is the most comprehensive study of health and nutrition ever conducted. Dr. Campbell is a professor emeritus at Cornell University and is most well known for co-authoring the best-selling book, The China Study, with his son, Thomas Campbell, MD. In May of 2013, Dr. Campbell published Whole. Then in February 2014, The Low Carb Fraud. And this year, he will be coming out with the second edition of The China Study. He has also been featured in the very successful documentary, Forks Over Knife. And the most recent documentary, which is premiering around the country, entitled Plant Pure Nation. He was trained at Cornell University and MIT in nutrition, biochemistry, and toxicology. Dr. Campbell spent 10 years on the faculty of Virginia Tech's Department of Biochemistry and Nutrition before returning to Cornell in 1975, where he presently holds his endowed chair as the Jacob Gould Schumann Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry in the Division of Nutritional Sciences. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I interviewed you 5 years ago about the China study. So let's back up a bit and talk about how you got involved in the China Project. And could you share with our listeners what you discovered in this project, which really was the basis of the book, The China Study?
Yes, there was really a China Project that we called it in those days that started in 1980 when a visitor from China, one of the senior scientists in China came to the United States. He was the first one. He came to my laboratory. We worked together for about a year or so. And then we learned about the opportunity that was available in China to study the reason why cancer was so common in certain counties in China and much less common in others. That observation was done by the Chinese government. They produced an atlas, a map, if you will, of cancer rates around the country. And so we organized the study. Dr. Chen and I did, along with our colleague at Oxford University and another Chinese senior fellow. And we got funding from the U.S. government. That's the National Institutes of Health. And, of course, the Chinese government and a little bit from the U.K. government. But in any case, this was the first research project between the United States and China in those days. And so we went to China starting in the fall of 1983. And we surveyed a total of 130 villages around the country. When I say we, I'm using it a little bit liberally. It was actually my Chinese colleagues who did all of that. I was obviously involved in the planning and execution of it, but they were the ones who really did the work. And we surveyed 130 villages and we collected all kinds of information, basically blood samples, urine samples, food samples. We asked questions, and of course then we had access to the list of the disease rates for about 4 dozen different kinds of diseases for all those counties. And I said that wrong before. I'm sorry. It was 65 counties, 130 villages.
Okay.
We had 2 villages in every county. That was done for experimental purposes, just to validate if we could the measurements we were making. It was a nicely organized study, I think, thanks to my colleague in particular at Oxford University. And then in the fall of 83, we collected all that information, a little more in the spring of 1984, gathered all that together. It was a tremendous amount of information. And finally entered into the rudimentary computers of the day in the late 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
In 1990, by that time we had gone through all the data to make sure there were no errors and things like that. It was published as a really big book called The Monograph. And there were about 100,000 correlations in there of various factors with other factors. And that then was a study that, quite frankly, is a human study, obviously. But the study was undertaken primarily because of the opportunity, just for interest sake, but also it was undertaken from my perspective to see if we might see in a human population the same thing that I was exploring and doing research on for the previous 25 years in the laboratory. And so then finally in 2005, we published the book called The China Study and summarized that 40 plus years worth of research, including all the work in the laboratory as well as what we learned in the human population study in China. The book took the name, The China Study. That was not my sons and I first choice. It wasn't our choice at all. That son, incidentally, Tom Campbell, then went off to medical school after that. He's now got a really nice position, University of Rochester Medical Center in family medicine. But in any case, the book, The China Study, summarized all the information, and in that book we discussed the work I had done in the early part of my career, plus of course the China study data itself, and then we collected other information from other sources of other researchers as well. And finally wrote what I thought to be true, what I had learned over all those many years, and it was a story that quite frankly, was very different. It's almost just about the opposite of what I believed when I first started my career as a graduate student in 1956. At that time, I was raised on a farm, a dairy farm, and believed in the good old American diet, high in protein and fat and so forth. And, so that was, and I got involved in teaching that and starting the research career on that idea that the best diet was the high-protein, high-fat diet typically consumed by Americans. But then all the information that I started to gather over the years, especially after beginning a project in the Philippines in 1967, an idea came into view that I was really interested in exploring, and that was the question concerning the effect of food on cancer, more specifically the effect of dietary protein on liver cancer. And that, in turn, generated a rather nice grant from the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Cancer Institute, that continued for the next 27 years. And those 27 years were very productive. We learned a lot of things, how protein affects cancer development in experimental animals. It was an opportunity for us to explore in considerable depth the mechanisms by which this relationship occurs. And these mechanisms, by the way, are obviously for 99% similar, I'm sure, between all mammalian species, including the human. So the things we learned were applicable to human as well. We learned things like that nutrition actually was the major factor in controlling whether or not cancer occurs. We learned that we could turn cancer on, not make it grow, that is, when we increased the intake of protein. It was an animal-based protein. We could turn it off when we took it away or reduced it and replaced it with plant-based food or plant protein. So animal protein was a very potent promoter of development of that cancer that we were working with. It was quite remarkable. And as I said, we could turn it on or turn it off. We learned some other things that were very novel at that time. One was that I was interested in understanding the so-called biochemical mechanism by which this works. So we started exploring possible mechanisms, which enzyme did this, which it did that, and that kind of thing. And that was probably one of the most significant things I think I did during my entire career. And what we learned was there was no such thing as a single mechanism, which is typically understood by people developing drugs. In this case, there was a whole variety of mechanisms all working together to produce the response.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be a really fundamental idea because that's the way nutrition works. Nutrition works through a multitude of mechanisms involving a multitude of nutrients and nutrient-like substances from food. And in the end, it has an effect and is able to cause, let's say, with the wrong food, it's able to cause a really quite a variety of different kind of diseases, from heart disease to diabetes to cancer and so forth. And so the whole thing, when you sit back and look at it, you know, endless nutrients, if you will, other substances in food operating through endless mechanisms, you know, in the body to produce a large variety of possible diseases, if we're consuming the wrong food, that is. And that concept kind of rounded up in a way when I decided to try to figure out, you know, how can I explain all this stuff? And that led to the book Whole, Whole. It was published in 2013 when I'm there offering a rather different idea of thinking about nutrition.
Right. So you're talking about reductionism versus holism.
Absolutely. Reductionism is almost the name of science. They're almost synonymous with science. I mean, in science, what we do, we basically study things mostly in isolation. We look at the effects of one thing at a time, like one nutrient, or we assume there's one mechanism. We talk about that and one outcome, just maybe one kind of cancer. And that kind of thinking is wrong, is dead wrong, literally. That kind of thinking is applicable to the discovery of drugs. Because the drug people, they like to discover, you know, a drug for each condition. You know, it's a bigger market, more money.
Right.
And so the whole drug idea, which we pretty much depend on, unfortunately, in Western societies, you know, to treat disease, I think it's just grossly wrong. I'm going to be that strong in that.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And from all my research, nutrition plays the biggest factor in the creation or eliminating a disease in a body. Many doctors don't even study nutrition. They're not really taught this to any great extent in medical school. Why do you think that is?
Very good question. Doctors don't necessarily choose not to study nutrition. That's an institutional question for the most part. And on that basis, the practice of medicine or the industry of medicine, if you will, it's really focused on the use of drugs. Believing, for example, that the best way to deal with sickness is to develop a specific drug for a specific condition. I mean, that's almost considered to be the hallmark of science, of good science. Knowing exactly how much to give, when to give it, and so forth. And that's basically the practice of medicine. And so with that kind of thinking, very, very reductionist, they're not taught nutrition because nutrition is from a different world. Nutrition, as I mentioned before, is where you got these endless substances and food all working together as food, relying on the body to organize things the way it sees fit. And it turns out the formula for good health is virtually the same for preventing all these diseases. It's just basically consuming whole plant-based foods without dumping back a lot of, you know, fat, sugar, and salt. And figuring out how to match foods, and it's not a big question. Just eating vegetables and fruits and grains and legumes and nuts. You put them all together, you can make some delicious dishes, obviously.
Okay, so I want to back up just a little bit more, back up to the China study a little bit. You received some criticism when this book came out. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I sort of took it semi-seriously in the beginning, but it turned out all of that criticism, I mean all of that criticism, made any news at all, if you will, was a criticism that was prepared by a couple of people who had no training in science, no experience, weren't even taught science. They, a couple of young people, were working in close collaboration with a group in Washington that basically is a ag lobbying group.
Mm-hmm.
And so they... And also at the same time while they're doing this, at least for one, I happen to be privy to the kind of emails that person was sharing with others, but it turned out that these criticisms were fairly well written. You know, they're good writing young people, but they also had, at least in one case, and I'm pretty sure in the second case, they had a big backup of, like, in one case I know it was like 40-some people reviewing their drafts as they went forward.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of an organized effort to say anything that they could see to say to discredit the China study. I mean, the China study did make big news. The book came out and a lot of people found it quite valuable. And it was obviously a confrontation, I guess you could say, or a collision course with the way we do things, especially the kind of food we eat. And so the industries that are prominent in our food business, namely the livestock industry and its various kinds, the dairy industry in particular, they didn't like this message. And they have not warmed up to it at all ever since. And so those criticisms that were raised, there were a couple, arguably, you might say, were reasonable points to make. But what they did with it, with that information, it completely ignored what I had already said in the book itself. I mean, just to give an example, one of the chief criticisms was that I shouldn't be drawing conclusions from correlation, like in the China study. There are two answers to that. One is I didn't do that. In fact, I wrote about it. I wrote about it beforehand that you shouldn't do that. But they, of course, ignore what I had written. They pretended they didn't know that. And the second thing is they also were saying things like, since I was using all these correlations, allegedly using all these correlations, the only place where they could even imagine I might be doing that was in the China study itself. And the China study itself, the results from China study, was published in only one of the 18 chapters. All the China study really was an attempt, a rather interesting attempt, I should say, was a very nice attempt to compare in a human population to see if what you're seeing in the experimental studies and what others were doing to see if it was consistent with what we saw in China.
Mm-hmm.
And the China population was a very nice population to study because it was a population in rural China where they're consuming diets mostly plant-based foods, you know, low in fat, very low in fat. And so it's an ideal population to sort of examine whether or not the work that I was getting in the laboratory was applicable to humans. And so I don't know what else to say about those criticisms. I'd usually get quite angry at them. I know in one case, this one young gal, she was writing to say that even when this was pointed out to her that she wasn't even talking about the stuff beyond the China study, and I pointed out in one of my reviews that, you know, about the experimental work we're doing. So she decided to look at that. And then she just flat out lied she said that the Indian work that we originally started with, where they showed that high protein increases liver cancer, she went and found another paper of theirs where they claimed that it was a reverse, as if I didn't know it. And she basically inferred that I was a fraud, that I kept that from people. Mm-hmm. That went around the internet. And so, quite frankly, the second paper the Indian workers had done was nothing to do with cancer. In fact, I knew that second paper very well, and I had a graduate student who did their PhD and spent 4 years working out, you know, how that was related or not related. And I didn't overlook it. It just wasn't included in the book. But so those criticisms, ever since I've come to realize, for the most part, they're coming from people who have no training in science. For the most part, there's the two or three people who have offered criticisms who are trained in medicine. But those folks are the ones who are also supporting the low-carb diet. Mm-hmm. And again, they're not people who actually were trained in nutrition. Mm-hmm. And they virtually know nothing about research, and they've never published any papers in a professional literature in which their comments are held being held accountable for their comments. So all those criticisms, and I really mean that, really all the criticisms that really people read in the public were on the internet, written by people not trained in the area, or in some cases, some people trained in medicine, but with no training in nutrition and no training in research. I don't even know where to begin or to end.
I want to talk a little bit about low-fat diets. Early 90s, late 80s, you know, that was the big deal with the low-fat diets and all the low-fat food. And that was really, in my opinion and many other people's opinion, that was really a disaster when those guidelines came out and people were buying all this food that was touted as being low-fat. But the problem with that was that those low-fat foods were very high in sugar.
The cheap document that was used to establish the so-called low-fat diet, according to the people who are making that comment, the cheap document that was used for that interpretation, I was a co-author of the paper. I was a co-author of the report. It was a report done by the National Academy of Sciences. There were 13 of us. We studied for 2 years, worked on it really hard, came up with that report, published in 1982, right? What we said, and we only suggested as a goal for people to consider, we reviewed the effects of different nutrients according to the evidence we had in those days, what relationship it might have to do with cancer, and we published a chapter on each of those nutrients, more or less. And we just made a series of six suggestions or goals. And one was to start working toward a lower fat diet. We actually said in the executive summary that the 30% figure, was lower than the 35 to 37%, which just a little bit of a drop, just kind of indicated to people, this is the direction you got to think about going toward. We also had a second recommendation to consume more plant-based foods. So it was a strategy that was put there that way. Actually, I was about the only ones. I thought, well, we probably shouldn't say anything about fat at all because it's only just a small little, it's certainly not low fat. And we said, you know, that was almost the entree of all the reports to the idea of consuming plant-based foods. It got a lot of circulation. In fact, that report was the most sought-after report in the history of the National Academy of Science. I testified before congressional committees. I was interviewed on public television and featured in People magazine and so forth. So they're taking that report and they're saying, you know, oh, low-fat diets is supposed to be what we're supposed to do, and they called it low-fat. It was never a low-fat diet. It was not even called a low-fat diet. It was still 30%. That's not low-fat. And ever since then, the people who have gotten away with this argument, oh, we tried that experiment with low-fat. We didn't try the experiment. Not whatsoever. Never went down. It's not low fat. We didn't try it. And so that's a total myth. It's really horrible. I know what they were doing. It was people like Atkins and his crowd it was a reaction against the idea that we should even be implants in the first place. And they came up with what they thought was a clever way to try to tell the public, oh, you know, we tried that low-fat diet and didn't work, and really it's all about carbohydrate. And they would also say it, you had to consume a low-carb diet. And again, they misrepresented the facts, because carbohydrate, there's more or less two kinds. One is refined, the other is natural. And they would say low-carb, meaning all the carbohydrates, that meant basically not, you know, cutting down on the consumption of plants, because that's the only place we get carbohydrates. So it was a very subtle but very powerful advertising technique to get people to forget about this idea of consuming plants because it got all that carbohydrate. Had they limited their comments just to the refined carbohydrates, and sometimes they would mention this when they're called account, called on that, but basically the refined carbohydrates, sugars and white starch, for example, refined that way, we can all agree. That's not what we're talking about. We didn't talk about it in that report. They were just trying to smear the report and smear this attempt by just coming up with these sort of clever ad lines. And so it's been today, you know, ever since. And, I've debated one of them once in a formal debate at the University of Alabama Cancer Center. I made this point. And when we had the rebuttal, I said, don't say that because that's not what we did. He acted like he never even heard us say it. He just kept on, because that was the ad line. That was the marketing line. And so they keep on saying it because they saw the other things they say, too, just to try to smear this whole area. They'll say, for example, that I'm a vegan activist, or, you know, I'm promoting a vegan diet. My God, I never even knew the word when I started my research. That was the furthest from any thought that I ever had. And I explained, went through this, some of this at a discussion group on one occasion that ended up having 10,000 comments. I explained that this is not what we did. It's not what I did. And I'm not talking about a vegan diet. And they wrote back and said, we're going to call you a vegan activist anyhow. Mm-hmm. And so what the public needs to know is that this so-called discussion that's going on in the public, you know, regarding the science, there's one camp of people who have lots of money behind them. They'd like to tell good things about bad habits, you know, so people buy their books. And that's the name of the game. It's not science. And so that's the reason I came up with the whole food plant-based diet concept, that wording, because I wanted the reader to know I had no agenda to promote the V diets. None. Zero. What I learned was something exactly opposite what I first thought, and it was simply based on doing the basic fundamental research, which none of those guys ever did.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a terrible, terrible disconnect.
I know you don't like this word, but just from my research, the average vegan diet is about 30% fat. And you propose a much lower level of fat, around 10 or 12. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So how do you think people need to get that fat? What's your ideal way to get that fat?
Well, just eating. There are plenty of plant foods have enough fat in them, and they have the really good fats on the top of it. And they have a nice ratio of the omega-6 to omega-3, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, things like nuts, seeds, even grains to some extent, a little bit there. Legumes are a great place to get plenty of fat. And these days, exactly. I mean, if we're just eating a whole food plant-based diet, eating whole foods and, you know, using some nuts along the way and plenty of legumes, we'll get all the fat we need. And we don't even need to think about it.
Okay. What about salmon? Do you think we should not eat salmon?
Well, here's the way I like to talk about these hard and fast recommendations, if you will. Well, here's the one I'd like to stand on the best. I like to say that the goal in all of this is to go to 100% plant, you know, whole food plant-based, right? But I also know that, you know, a lot of people can enjoy pretty good health, not quite getting there. We know that. The same as some people can smoke all their lives and claim they got to be 95 because they were smoking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the name of the game here. So it's all about weight of evidence, about odds, statistics, and things like that. which most people aren't too comfortable talking about, I guess. But in any case, I say the goal is 100%. And the reason I say that is not because I have the absolute proof, you know, for everybody all the time. That's not the point. But the weight of the evidence points that that's the best of all lives. And so I say to myself, well, how can you get to 100%? Well, one thing that you have to kind of people have to overcome to get there if they want to do that. And that is not using an added fat and oils. In other words, get down to the oil that's generally offered by a whole food plant-based diet, you know, around 10 or 12% or so. And don't be adding back all that oil and stuff like that. Don't use fried foods. Don't use the oil dressings and stuff like that. And for a lot of people, that sounds, oh, that's going too far. That's kind of weird. You know, that I can't do that. Well, what they need to know is that we, all of us, have been addicted to fat. It's a great substance to create these addictions. And so once we become addicted to fat, even if you want to eat all plant-based foods, people have a hard time getting away from the oil. And they still want to do that, and you're quite correct. The best study I know of, vegans still use 30% oil because, again, they don't seem to understand this. And so once you get to the 10%, don't be adding all that stuff back. It's amazing. I did it. My family did it. A lot of friends. We've all done it. What happens is that we become de-addicted, just like, you know, we can get away from cigarettes, too. We can get away from the caffeine and coffee if we want to. We just give ourselves a month or two at most for most people. And all of a sudden, we discover new tastes, and we don't want that oil in the fat. And when we go back and even put a little bit, it's nasty. And so you just discover a whole new world of eating and tasting and health.
Well, for me personally, I'm going to use myself because, you know, I'm the only one that knows how I feel and I know about my health is I don't eat red meat. I do eat eggs. I only eat pastured eggs, and I consume some chicken, and I eat a little bit of salmon. The oils that I use are extra virgin, 100% extra virgin olive oil, and I use a little bit of avocado oil, and I use coconut oil pretty consistently. And this diet works for me, for my health.
How old are you, if you don't mind my asking? Or just in the general ballpark figure, you don't need to tell me.
No, I don't mind telling you. I'm 62 years old.
Okay.
And I feel great, and I have a lot of energy. Again, I eat a lot of plants. I eat a green juice almost daily. Start my day with juice of kale and celery and spinach, and I mix it up, but I've added that to my diet almost daily. I feel like I need some eggs. Otherwise, I feel hungry. I don't feel satisfied. And I think personally for me, I have found a diet that works for me. So what do you say to that?
Well, first off, I didn't tell you the second half of my general recommendation that, you know, the goal is to go 100%. And in any case, I also say I honor the step that everybody takes toward that goal. I happen to believe in free choice. No way do I like to proselytize.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't like to make judgment. You know, certainly not about people's choices.
Mm-hmm.
All I can talk about is what I know best, and that's the science. So I can defend, you know, the science that I think quite well, what I just told you. As far as what people choose to do with that, that's their business. And, you know, a lot of people, as I said before, they can go quite a few more years than what you have done so far and still do fairly well. The problem is if you look at the rates of cancer, rates of heart disease, rates of this, rates of that, I can say maybe the best way to illustrate that, there's a lot of 62-year-old people who may not be doing quite as well as you are, but are more or less eating that kind of food, have already had a heart attack. And, you know, their risk of getting a heart attack is greater. It's that simple. Then let's say a person eating a whole food plant-based diet without the oil. And so, again, we're playing with the odds. We're playing odds, and we're playing with a bit of a game, you know, hoping we're not going to be that, that one person that might, be of some risk, you know, for even doing that. But all I can talk about is the, just look at the evidence. Look at the, you know, the rates of disease, you know, relative to the kinds of food being consumed and so forth. And it's quite clear. It's really quite clear. Heart disease is already becoming, significant at people like your age, obviously. There's quite a lot of people 62 years and younger have already had an attack. That's really what happened. And there's also a lot of people like yourself who keep on going, maybe for another 20, 30 years. So all we can do is just talk about the science.
So my next question is, are you familiar with some of the work done by Dr. William Davis and Dr. Perlmutter?
I can't say they did any work, to be honest with that. They wrote books.
You have an opinion about that. I'd like to hear that.
Yeah. Perlmutter, neither one of them did I get very far in their reading material. I got enough. I didn't want to read more because they all follow the same line. They tend to be opposed to what I'm talking about for starters. You know, they don't like the whole food plant-based idea. In the case of Davis, he also brought in a new concept that has really caught on quite a bit. I think he participated in this at least. And that's the whole gluten question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we supposedly have a lot of gluten sensitive people around. And that took off like a shot. It was another way of claiming we ought not to be eating grains or at least go very careful on them. That's, you know, the source of carbohydrate, and you don't want that according to this kind of argument. And so first thing you know, there's stuff in the popular literature that 20 to 30% or more of us are gluten sensitive. And when in fact, the more recent data that have been really obtained quite well and really good research shows that the rate of gluten sensitivity, for example, is more in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%. It can be serious. I don't want to diminish, you know, that problem. But the whole irritable bowel syndrome, you know, involving different kinds of sort of related diseases, that thing is common enough, but not nearly as common as what we're trying to think. So the gluten problem is not nearly as serious as what a lot of people make it out to be. And Davis was really behind a lot of that. It was one of those techniques, again, to get the people to begin doubting the consumption of certain classes of plant-based foods.
Well, go ahead.
He's a physician, and I haven't seen pictures of him, but I have lately. So I should be careful about that. But he doesn't do too well on his diet, I would say. Leave it at that. Perlmutter, brain drain.
Grain brain and brain maker.
Yeah, those are clever words, I should say. Again, what I have read in there, his science is, I'd have to go back and look in some detail, but his science is simply not impressive. And in fact, it hardly exists. He's not really done the scientific research that's necessary for that kind of thing. He writes about some studies and stuff in order to make his case, but in his view, what he's talking about too is not part of the holistic, you know, thing, the fact of nature, if you will. Let me explain that. Try to explain that a little bit better. The whole food plant based diet, it turns out, the way it works, and you I guess read that in the book Whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all that stuff really works together, and it has this amazing breadth of effect for all the different organs of our body and all the preventing all these variety of diseases. It can't be perfect, but boy, it's the closest thing to perfection that I've ever seen in my career. And it's hard to imagine that one kind of diet is good for one organ and a different diet for another organ. I don't believe that for a second. And the brain, you know, also is just what is part of that discussion. And so it's a little bit too focused, you know, on one activity or one organ, if you will. Everybody likes to keep their brains active. So I don't know. I can't say too much more about that.
You know, I've done a lot of research on grains and interviewed a lot of people, including Dr. Davis. And on my program, I have people who have plant-based diets, people who are paleo, people, you know, all the names. So I like to just give the information from a different perspective, which is what I'm talking with you about today. But for my research on grains, all grains are not created equal.
Right.
Okay, so our wheat has been very hybridized.
Right.
Our wheat also, unless you're buying organic wheat, it is sprayed with Roundup because Roundup is glyphosate, which is used as a desiccant or a drying agent. So you're getting the Roundup on your wheat. So I think that's an important fact. I do not eat gluten. I do eat some grains. I eat quinoa. I eat some brown rice. But I don't think all wheat is created equal.
I agree with everything you said.
Okay.
Because the wheat, and unfortunately too many other varieties of food as well these days,
mm-hmm.
Has actually been gone through some inbreeding and crossbreeding and that sort of thing over the years. It's not quite the same as what it was in the heirloom sort of period, if you will. So what we have today, yeah, it's treated, it's exposed to some chemicals we'd rather not, you know, be consuming.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly what they are doing necessarily. My wife and I just not for an occasional wheat, but we like organic foods. But in any case, we like to go organic, whether it's wheat or any other kind of food substance. It just sort of just makes sense.
Right. I mean, it's hard to argue with pesticides on food versus not having pesticides on food. And I actually consider myself somewhat of an expert on GMOs and glyphosate, and I speak about this quite often. So I think it's an important thing to be talking about when we're talking about our food, because, you know, the World Health Organization recently stated that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen. I know organizations that have couple thousand studies on the effects of GMOs and glyphosate. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's an important issue, whether you choose to eat grains or not eat grains, or, you know, whether you have gluten sensitivity or not. And I think some of that gluten sensitivity may in fact be from the chemicals.
It could be.
Yeah. I
haven't seen proof of that, but nonetheless, it's a reasonable hypothesis.
The leaky gut, do you think this is fabricated or do you think this is real? You know, talking about the microbiome and gut health is important to our immune system. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I may be almost no one knows this, but I may have been done the first microbiome experiment of anyone in the country. I did it for my master's degree in 1957. And the whole microbiome thing didn't even start. That discussion didn't start until about 10 years ago at best. And it was just a happenstance kind of thing. It was my master's thesis. I was taking the organisms from the chinchilla. He had a little chinchilla animal, which lives in the Andes in the mountains of Peru. They digest very high levels, they digest a high percentage of dietary fiber. And rabbits digest about half as much, even though rabbits are quite good. So I took the organisms from the chinchilla, intubated the rabbits, put it in the rabbits, and actually doubled their rate of digestion fiber. So it proved to me that these organisms were important. And then I also, in my PhD thesis, I was using cows and sheep. And I operated on them to create one of those windows that you might have heard of. You know, you can go in and dip out the contents, the microbial contents.
Mm-hmm.
And my PhD thesis was, generally speaking, it was for the purpose of figuring out more efficient ways of producing animal protein. As I said, that was my belief in those days. But in that process, we were doing that by feeding cows this nitrogen-containing compound called Biret to see if organisms might, you know, totally synthetic, unnatural compound. I was simply interested in seeing if the ecology of those organisms in the rumen would be such that, you know, maybe a new organism would step forward and mutate be able to hydrolyze that biuret. Because if it could do that, then it would turn it into urea molecules, and the organisms in there could use the urea molecules to make microbial protein, which then in turn the animal did digest it. So a lot of my thesis, and that was in the years of 1958 to 61. Then, people cited and talked about it a little bit for 10 years or so after that, but in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was a very robust amount of research being done on the microorganisms in the human gut. They were using experimental animals too. And so they learned a lot of things. They learned that meat eating tends to increase a certain kind of microorganisms called anaerobes, which in turn had the capability, presumably, of digesting or hydrolyzing the acids that are normally there, creating a product that was could promote tumors. That was one of the areas of research. There was a lot of research done on the digestion of fiber, like I had done earlier. And there was a lot of work on that. And then it was principally done by a laboratory called the American Health Foundation, which actually was using National Institutes of Health money to do it. Good scientists, good money, good scientists, a lot of publications. In fact, I was the chair of their research advisory committee on outside for a little while. And so I knew these people, and they had done great research. But then all of a sudden people come along, this microbiome group come along in the 90s, not even that, I think almost early 2000s, and they come along and start to, oh, you know, these bugs in the intestine, they might be important. You know, they do this and they do that. There's a whole new field emerged. They called it microbiome because now they had access to being able to do a DNA fingerprint kind of analyses of the organisms too. And so it's really become a fairly robust area at the present time. I know when I'm reading the research from that community, I see in there what their motivation is in some of these papers. And basically it comes down to this. If we can just learn about this bug or, you know, this organism or that one doing this or that or something else, that maybe we can, you know, change that. We can introduce the organism. We can change the, maybe do a little DNA work and just change the population a bit. Or at least learn, the kind of products that are being produced by these organisms that in turn might relate to the immune system, for example, or other kinds of systems in our body, good or bad. If it's good, we can take, you know, we can harvest those chemicals, and we can synthesize them, and maybe we can make a drug out of them. And so that's my take on it. I've followed that for so long, but these people in the modern day, they don't even know that it seems like they never cite any of this earlier work that was already very active at that time. And so it's a recycling of an old idea.
Okay, but you don't think that the science could get better?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, the science area and that scientific area was well worth doing. I'd be a strong advocate for that work continuing because there's a lot to be learned. The population, that ecology of organisms in the gut is beyond comprehension. The complexity of that is beyond comprehension. And there's so many different kind of organisms at any point in time. And they change. They change their characteristics from time to time. So it's a very dynamic, you know, kind of population. And it does respond to food, very much so. And the problems with, let's say, consuming meat, for example, are such that we've already learned that meat will create, they don't say it in the modern day, but I know it from the older days, it creates these anaerobes, which in turn might be similar to other organisms that produce this compound called trimethylamine oxide that tends to correlate with high intakes of meat, which in turn correlates with colon cancer, as I remember. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, some interesting observations that are being produced. It's kind of a neat little observation, mm-hmm. but it's a detail that only just serves the purpose of emphasizing a bigger picture.
Yeah. Well, like grains, I think not all meat is created equal as far as the quality of our meat, the antibiotics, and the amount of animals that are fed GMO grains. That is way different than a farmer that's raising 100% grass-fed beef. So wouldn't the effects be totally different on our body with those two different kinds of meats?
No, absolutely not. The evidence for grass-fed meat originally started with a fellow professor at Emory University. He's considered to be the father of the paleo diet, for example. I was just with him, a very fine gentleman. We were in a meeting together, but he actually was studying at the time wild meat, you know, meat from wild animals, mm-hmm. pointing out that the ratio of the kinds of fatty acid present in wild animals was healthier, according to his interpretation, than that's fed, you know, in the feedlot. And he had a point. But it's really interesting. We worked, there were 20 of us. We've been pretty active in our field for a long time. And we just came up with a report, just was announced today, that we were advocating, you know, consuming more plant-based foods and stuff like that. And it was pointed out in particular, he went along with that, which I know he did. And so I don't know what this paleo college you want to say now, but that whole question concerning grass-fed meat versus feedlot meat, first off, we got to look at the whole picture. Grass-fed animals, quite frankly, you know, animal per animal, give off more methane than does the feedlot. So they're worse in that way, according to those who have been able to analyze that. I have not done that, but that's what they say. And also the grass-fed animals, yeah, they have a little bit better profile of fatty acids than the feedlot. The feedlot animals are fed corn. We call it concentrate in my day when we were working on a farm. The feedlot animals give a lot of concentrated energy, grain meal, or corn meal in particular. Corn is loaded with the omega-6 fatty acid, linoleic acid. And so that creeps in and gets into the meat, flesh of the barnyard animals, if you will, or the feedlot animals. And that's not so good. Omega-6 is a very pro-inflammatory. And omega-3s, which you see more of the wild, is anti-inflammatory. So you see a few things that where the wild, the one on the grass, might be a shade better. But I know of no evidence, none yet, that shows, gram for gram or pound for pound, that eating the grass-fed animals are going to be any better. And we might theorize and hypothesize and all that sort of stuff and imagine that may be true. But quite frankly, I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is because the main characteristic of meat that causes it to behave the way it does is the protein. And the protein is not different between grass-fed and feedlot. And the amount of protein in the two different classes of meat is approximately the same. So, I don't think in the future, I wish I were around 50 years from now or 100 years from now to see if they ever found any data to show that grass-fed animals are healthier than the feedlot animals. I really doubt it.
Well, if you're thinking about reductionism versus holism, though, could that could be a big factor.
How so?
Well, because when you're studying the meat and what it does to the body, if you have a meat that you have something like a chemical like glyphosate in there because of the GMO corn that they have consumed, would that not play a factor?
It could. That's a very reductionist argument, but
I'm just throwing that out there.
It's interesting what you said, but keep in mind, protein content or the amount of protein in those two different kinds of meats, for example, is about the same, both in its characteristics as well as its quantity. quality about the same. And the meat, and that is a really important consideration, because not only do we see direct effects of the protein, which is going to be the same, you know, I'm talking about mechanism by which these proteins work, they're going to be the same. But even more to the point, when we're making up our diet composed of meat, whether it's white meat, red meat, range-fed meat, feedlot, whatever, the biggest thing that you have to, the biggest factor in there actually is the protein. Not just because what it does for itself, you might argue that's a little reductionist, but what, in a holistic argument, what happens when you do that, you're displacing the consumption of the foods we need to eat, namely the plant-based foods. That makes it a whole, you know, a more holistic kind of argument. And so, the ideal diet, in my view, as I said, is the one that's whole food plant-based. And the moment you start putting in some of those other kinds of foods in there, I mean, if it's a small amount, yeah, most people can get away with doing that, not worry about it. But, people don't quite behave that way. They don't use it, you know, really lightly. And so, yeah, I don't expect to see the day when grain-fed meat is going to be necessarily shown to be much different than feedlot, if at all. The other thing is, too, is that if we told the public, oh, you know, grain-fed meat is good, it's a lot better, quite frankly, exaggerate the argument, then what happens is that you have to raise a different question. Is the population really, do we have enough land just to all of a sudden start eating grain-fed meat? Not even close.
You mean grass-fed meat?
Yeah.
Well, right. And if, I agree with you on your point there, because I watch Cowspiracy, and that was really eye-opening. And I know that the factory farming is a huge contributor. It's a huge contributor to our greenhouse gases. And it's not sustainable at all. But they did raise the issue that you were just talking about with the grass-fed, is where are we going to find this much land to do it? I mean, if you look at the rainforests in the Amazon, it's being depleted, and most of that is from overgrazing.
That's right. Absolutely. I've seen that myself.
It's interesting. So my guess is, and I want to talk just briefly after I ask this question at the end, I want to talk about Plant Pure Nation, but I'm curious, and I think I know you know how you're going to answer this, but I want to ask the question anyway. How do you feel about the blood type diet? Do you think there's any merit to that?
Well, I remember that occasion when I got that book, because I did allow in my mind for the possibility I might have some argument here, because after all, blood type, you know, is pretty genetically controlled, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? So I got to the book. I got to page 35. I had to lay it down. I couldn't read more because the science was so bad. And so I gave it to a couple of my postdocs, and they too, because I don't want to read this. It was the science really was not good. And he talked about, you know, being type O or A or B or whatever. I think it's O plus or something like that.
O positive.
Yeah, you're supposed to eat meat. Well, I'm O positive and I don't eat meat. So I was on the wrong foot there, I guess.
It's interesting because I'm an A, and I've never really been drawn to meat. And not just for health reasons. I just tend to like chicken or fish. And that's pretty much what an A is all about. So I have found some people who have had some success in changing their diet according to this. So I think there's some controversy. I think there might be some merit to it, but
I look with a jaundiced eye on authors who write these kind of books and then turn around and sell a bunch of nutrient supplements and, you know, to make it well. And you know, when there's a monetary motivation, you know, involved in these kind of things, I have to look a second time, you know, at the science. But in any case, the blood type thing, the blood type diet, I don't have any colleagues at all who actually subscribe to, you know, believe in that. I'm talking about people on both sides of the argument. I mean, it's still popular with the public to some extent, but if you talk about change, that incident, I should mention that the blood type diet, in effect, allows for, as you know, the consumption of meat, they can go along with a low carb diet easy enough and stuff like that. Well, it turns out that the low carb diet will, you know, by the way, low carb diet, as you know, is high in protein and fat. Okay.
Right.
That kind of diet does pretty consistently cause people to lose some weight. That's a given. And in some cases, maybe quite a lot if people have a lot to lose. And so it looks good. It looks good on that score in the beginning. But then, that's just the initial sort of trial and error kind of thing where, in fact, what they also are doing is consuming much less calories. So it's not clear, you know, how much of that is due to the reduction in calorie consumption as opposed to the consumption of, let's say, high protein, high fat. In any case, so for a month or two or three, maybe, or even six, according to what the data show, you know, it looks kind of interesting, certainly for people who have weight to lose and they like that. But then within, I don't know, less than 6 weeks, but certainly you can measure the seat of 6 weeks, if you compare people on the low-carb diet with the people on, let's say, a more whole food plant-based diet, and this was, I'm talking about data right now that was actually buried in the text of a paper of one of the low-carb people. They actually published a paper, compared it, the low-carb diet with the average American diet and so forth. And, they documented, they didn't put it in the table, so you can't see it very well, but it's in the text. It used to be, you know, honest to keep it there. But the low-carb diet people eventually have more constipation. They have, and the differences, incidence, and the incidence is quite dramatic. They have worse breath, bad breath, more muscle cramps, and a bunch of things start setting in, including a rise in cholesterol levels. And then down the road a little further, they had much higher risk for heart disease. So the low-carb diet, that means Atkins, South Beach, to some extent the blood type diet, although it wasn't advertised for that purpose. To some extent, the grain diet wasn't advertised for that purpose. The South Beach, the Zone diet, the protein power diet, there's a bunch of them. They're all sort of under that general rubric referred to as the low-carb diet. And you can, as I say, the two things you can see. One is you see some reduction in body weight early on. It doesn't really last forever. And the second thing is you see all these side effects, unpleasant side effects that occur. I'm talking about stuff that's been published. It's in the published literature.
I think there's a lot of people that believe, and I'm one of them too. I think we all have different requirements for our body. We're all different. What works for me may not work for you, and vice versa. Would you agree with that?
I do have some problems with it because you know, there's a concept that's popular these days talking about biological individuality or functional medicine, some people call it, or integrative medicine, you know, where that argument is made throughout that we're all different. I know we're all different. We obviously are. How that translates into our requirements for good nutrition or food, I don't go along with that argument for two reasons. Number one, we are different when we respond to food, but we don't like, some people don't necessarily respond to food in one direction and another person in an opposite direction. For example, if people are put on a low carb diet or on a one extreme, put on a low carb diet, they don't end up after 2 or 3 or 4 years, they don't end up with a lower cholesterol level compared to people on a high carb diet. It just doesn't work. I mean, this is research 100 years old that published, you know, hundreds of times. People on a higher protein diet, animal protein diet, have higher cholesterol levels. End of story. They have a higher risk of cancer. They have a higher risk of heart disease. So whatever, you know, might be advantageous to them at the moment for a little bit, they feel better, you know, they lost some weight, it's not going to last. I mean, otherwise we have to, I don't know, go back and just rewrite all the, you know, all the previous research that's been done on this for the last 100 years. Just doesn't work out. And so, I don't know, I think the low-carb idea. It's just simply not right looking at the data. Also, I know it was a mischievous way of making an argument, you know, to get people not to take the plant-based food seriously. Incidentally, I liked meat myself. I drank all the milk you could imagine. I was milking cows by hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really was a total farm boy. In fact, my father only had 2 years of formal education, and I'm the first one to ever even go to college. And so for going to college for me was like going to the moon. And when I got into school, I ended up doing my doctoral dissertation on supporting what I believed as a high-protein, high-fat diet, because that's what I liked and that's what I did. And so I'm not that now, and it's not because I decided in the beginning I wanted to be this way. I wanted to be healthy, but the evidence that we did, and this is direct experimentation, it's not just, you know, reading about it in the library. We actually did the research. What I saw over that period of time just made me turn my head just in the opposite direction. So we can have our choices, we can have our preferences for this and that, think we're doing well and so forth and so on. And that's great as long as it's working, you know, for an individual, I guess. But what we're different in is we're different in the degrees to which we respond.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a quantitative difference. We all have, you might respond to 10% in one direction, and I'm 20%, and another time on another factor, you're 60%, 10%, whatever. You see the difference in degree. It makes it think that we are accustomed to different diets, or we have choices, we have a choice for different diets. But in reality, that's not really true, because it turns out if you take a bunch of people, they're all going to be different in the extent to which you'll see their cholesterol levels drop, or the extent to which something like that. Some of them may not drop at all, you know, just barely drop. Some of them a lot. So you see all these differences. Oh, you know, all these people have their own requirements. But what you don't see like half the people where the cholesterol goes down, the other half goes up. That doesn't happen. That simply doesn't happen. That's the kind of differences that would make a difference in our thinking. If that were happening, then we could say, oh yeah, some people should have meat and they'll see their cholesterol levels go down, and other people should have a plant-based diet and their levels will go down. That doesn't happen. I know of no evidence to suggest that's true. What we see is a difference in degree, but everybody goes in the same direction in response to the same kind of diet. Almost everybody.
Okay, well, I wish we had some time to talk about cholesterol a little bit, but we're almost out of time, and I wanted to talk with you about the movie Plant Pure Nation. Can you share with us a little bit about the movie and where it's showing now and where people can go to find out about it?
Sure. Thank you for the question. You know the film Forks Over Knives?
Yes.
Okay. That, as you know, featured my work and my colleague from Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Esselton, pretty much, and a lot of other friends. So that was out. And the producer of that film, John Corey, then joined my son, my older son, Nelson, to produce the new movie, Plant Pure Nation. My son Nelson is the director, John Corey is the producer. And that arose my son Nelson, his training's in economics and government and political science, and he's always had kind of an interest in that kind of angle of things. And what you and I haven't talked about in this interview is the experience I had, you know, in policy development in Washington. In any case, I can summarize it quickly. I spent a lot of time doing that, and I saw parts of this story that I thought I would never see. It's not the prettiest picture in the world, I can tell you. Politics and economics does play a major, major role in what we tend to believe. So when this movie came along, it came along because my friend, I was invited, and I asked for my friend to come along, Dr. Esselton. We were invited to come and speak on the floor of the Kentucky legislature, thanks to one of their senior members who'd been there for 30-some years, who heard me talk, he heard Dr. Esselton talk, and he wanted us to come and present and tell our story to the legislators, of which there were 100 in the chamber. So we did, and we were the first ones we were told. from the outside to smoke on the floor in 130 years or something like crazy like that. But in any case, the legislators were quite enthused with what we talked about. And eventually, the senior legislator that got us involved, he sat him down with 80 of the 100 and had him read the China study. They really took quite an interest in it. Well, so everything was going on quite nicely. And my son Nelson and the senior legislature got together and were talking about introducing some legislation that they might consider. So the legislation, you know, in favor of this, and changing the system, you know, for, you know, in the healthcare system in Kentucky. Well, that was all very exciting, kind of heady stuff, and we might get involved in that, but then the lobbyists came out and killed the bill. And it was very clear, in spite of the fact that the legislators themselves really liked the story, they voted against it in the end. It was a reasonably close vote, very surprisingly, but nonetheless, the bill was defeated. And then, after that, my son gets involved and going back and just wanting to show these legislators what happens if you give them a whole food plant-based diet. And he did that with groups of people. Had his own food, and very tasty, and they did it for 10 days for the most part, made before and after measurements, saw remarkable results. And so then, I won't say the rest of the movie because I want to leave it for people to see it if they haven't seen it, and that is that the whole idea then was taken back to the legislator, and sort of in a sense they see here, see what happens. You know, I won't say more about that. It's kind of a little bit dramatic in a sense. So it really goes to the question concerning why haven't we heard this before, this whole food plant-based diet idea? And it focuses on the question that we have to, you know, all this information gets filtered through our system, through our government and corporate systems. And so what the public gets to hear is not what, in fact, science may have produced. It's really, the product of the political economic system.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of exciting. I mean, he actually is using that, Nelson and John Corey, they're using that now with some other folks to create a national network of, you might call them wellness clubs, not quite, but they're very, very unique concept of organizing this network of communities. They call them pods and groups within the pods and stuff like that, where they can learn about all of this, and there'll be a lot of interchange between these groups, you know, on the internet and things like that. It's building a network that people can try this and see how it works.
And where can people go to find out more about this movie or where it's going to be showing?
Yes, plantpurenation.com. And it'll tell you on there how you can organize one of these pod communities, if you will. Or also, it's showing now, I don't know, it's showed in 100 and some theaters. I think it's already now available. DVD is available, I believe, and Netflix is going to pick it up, I believe, in early next year.
Well, thank you, Dr. Campbell. You've certainly given us some food for thought. And as I say to our listeners, whenever I interview someone, I really encourage people to do their own research. And your books are The China Study, and you're coming out with a new China Study. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're working on a second edition. Our publisher is kind of anxious for us to do that. And when I say we, I'm talking about my son, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's a physician. He, by the way, started in as a writer and an actor when he started working with me. And he got so excited about it, he went back to medical school. And now he's a physician and was a physician at University of Rochester Medical Center. And he's the director. He and his wife actually now direct a whole new program called Nutrition and Medicine.
Oh, great. And your other book is Whole?
I just want to mention his book is called The Campbell Plan. It's going to have a different name, but he has a book too.
Okay. Well, again, thanks for being a guest on our show, and we'll be back next week.